For this morning's talk, I said last night I would talk on insight, on how insight depends upon the power given to the mind by jhana, but also on the experience of the jhanas to understand some very profound life-changing insights. But before, everyone will know that there's no way one can get accurate insights when the Panchaniwarana, the five hindrances, are still active. So one of the jobs of samadhi is to eradicate, or rather suppress, those five hindrances, at least for the time being, to give you a window so you can see the truth. And it is true that the five hindrances are suppressed just prior to jhana, in what people call upachara samadhi. Now, upachara samadhi is a word, again, not found in the suttas. It was a word not used by the Buddha. But nevertheless, from my own experience, I accept this is true. There is such a thing as upachara samadhi. It just means just prior to jhana, when the five hindrances are overcome. Usually that means you're at the nimitta stage, and a very stable nimitta too. However, the problem is that just prior to jhanas, the five hindrances, they may be suppressed, but their suppression is very fragile and uncertain. They can come up again very easily. So yes, you suppress them, but not for long. And also that you will all know from my teachings and other teachings that even today people, monks, cannot agree what is jhana, what is not jhana. So let alone what is just prior to a jhana, an upachara. So because of that, many people try to develop insight, and they're not really even in upachara samadhi. So their insights have no force to eradicate the kilesha. But there is a second upachara which I like to point out to people. Just like when you came into this room, you went through the lobby area. And as you go out, you'll go out through the lobby area. The upachara, the threshold, is not just before the jhanas, but after the jhanas. And it's the post-jhana upachara which is the most powerful. The reason is because you know for certain, you've just entered and emerged from a jhana, you know that that must be upachara samadhi. And number two, that state lasts for a long period of time. Anyone who does achieve a jhana has the experience that hardly any, no defilements seem to enter the mind at all. Nothing can make you angry. For you monks, even the most beautiful girl won't excite you. Nothing can excite you just after the jhana. You are so still, peaceful, and hindrances, defilements seem to be totally absent for a period, and a long period. And that is why the post-jhana upachara is the place where most people gain their insights, which give them magapala, not before. Before is too unstable and uncertain. Afterwards is certain and stable. And anyway, as I like to tell people, if you're that close to jhana in upachara, why not take that last step? It's so easy, no hindrances left. You've got no barrier between you and the jhana. And to me, it's crazy that a person doesn't take that last step. Enter the jhanas, so that their upachara can last a long time rather than a short time. So, first of all, the test, if you have upachara prior to jhana, is if you can enter that jhana easily without any trouble. That's a sign you're at upachara. And now that you can understand that what most people say is upachara samadhi isn't upachara samadhi at all. They're still a ways away from jhanas, and the hindrances are very much still active. But it's not just the power of mind which jhanas give you. It's not just the fact that the post-jhana mind is free of defilements. It's also The jhana itself gives you the data on which to work. You have a bigger experience, a wider experience, what sometimes in the West we call a bigger picture, to understand what is happening. And in particular, I've already mentioned in passing, but not going into detail, and each one of these jhanas, things are missing. Things are missing which have always been there before. I could give the simile, Ajahn Chah's simile, of the two demons, invisible demons, pulling a rope around your neck. And because that rope has been pulled around your neck ever since you were born, you never know anything else except that constriction, that suffering. But once it's relieved for the first time, it comes as a surprise. I never realized how much suffering that was, because I'd got used to it. It is the nature of our brain, of our mind, only to notice things which change. Now, the best simile which I have come up with to explain what I mean of how when things disappear, they give rise to insight, is the simile of the tadpole and the frog. A tadpole has been born in the water and has grown up in the water and lived all its life in the water. And as the tadpole is growing up, it hears something called water, a name. But how can a tadpole know what water is? The tadpole might go to school and do the chemistry of water, being H2O. He might later go to spiritual teachers who would explain at length the nature of water and its opposite, dry land. He may even go to Abhidharma classes on water and see the different types of water. But nevertheless, he will not understand what water is. How can a tadpole understand what water is when it's been there all around him ever since he was born? But as you all know, a tadpole is just a baby frog. Soon that tadpole grows legs and little arms in the front. And when he grows those little legs and arms, he's able to jump out of the lake onto dry ground. And as soon as he jumps out of the lake for the first time, tadpole, now a frog, realize that this is a very strange experience. Standing on dry land is totally different to anything he's ever experienced before. In particular, something which had always been there for him, something which was always around him, so much so he could not notice, is now gone. Water. It's not there anymore. And for that tadpole, that's a strange experience. But if that tadpole, now a frog, has got any bit of wisdom at all, he will reflect, so that's what water was. That thing which is now not present. And now I understand what water is, because I have its opposite to compare it with. I have dry land. It's only when water disappears that a tadpole can know what water is. That's why a fish can never understand water. Tadpoles become frogs. Monks and nuns, upasakas, upasikas, can jump out of Kamaloka, the world of the five senses, into the jhana realms. And when you jump out for the first time, you get your first experience of a jhana. It is a very strange experience, nothing like you've experienced before. Just like the frog has never experienced this dry land business before. But once he's jumped out and reflects, he realized water was that thing which is now absent. And then he can understand water. In the first jhana, something is absent. Something which has always been there for you, even though you may not have used it, it's been at your command and control, your five senses. Yes, you can shut your eyes and not paying any attention. Yeah, you can plug up your ears at night with cotton wool so you don't hear your neighbor snoring. Yeah, you can somehow at times just have some anesthetic so you don't feel your body. But it's not the same as those things totally taken away from you. And I say this from experience. The only way you'll understand the five senses and this physical body is when it totally disappears in the jhanas. Only then do you understand what a body is, or rather what it was, and what these five senses are. Many people are attached to the world of the five senses. They like looking at pretty girls. They like thinking about sex or cricket. They like worrying about their money, their family, and their health and other things in this world. They like to build big fancy temples. Why? It's because they look for their happiness, their success, their well-being, everything in this world of the five senses. That's the only place they know. So that's the place they cherish. If you have experienced the jhana, you know what this five sense world really is. Your attachment to it will be taken away. Why am I bothered with these things when you know something which is far better? Even experience of first jhana and understanding the nature of the five senses gives you that amount of insight. And in particular, as I've pointed out many times, the major feature of any jhana is the bliss, is the happiness. People who experience that jhana for the first time, when they come and report to me, said, I've never experienced so much bliss, so much happiness, so much pure loveliness ever before. This is much better than anything else I've ever experienced in this life. Far better. It's the highest happiness you would have experienced. Now, sometimes people criticize me for this because I'm supposed to be a monk and be holy and I shouldn't even mention the word sex. But I am a modern monk. I was a layman before I became a monk. I wasn't born in brown robes. So I had sex before I became a monk. And that's very wonderful. I had those experiences, which means I know what I'm talking about. And meditation experiences is far better than sexual orgasm. I say that to all of you upasakas, upasikas. If you really want to have some fun, forget about your wife and girlfriends and get into jhanas. That's far, far, far more fun. And also you don't have problems like babies. But just the very intensity, purity and pleasure of the jhanas was something which shocked me. First of all, why is it that no one told me about that before? If you understand and can access those states, no way would you ever want to disrobe. No way would you ever want to abandon the holy life for the life of having a wife, watching movies and all that sort of stuff. You wouldn't even be interested in that. Why? Because you know a much greater pleasure. But even more than that, anyone who is interested in the Dhamma, who is inquisitive, will ask, why is that so pleasurable to be in even a first jhana? And what you realize is that the five senses, even in their most superlative form, the best sex, the most beautiful movie, the greatest music, whatever turns you on with the five senses, even the very, very highest, is suffering. It really is dukkha. You see that, because when it's gone, it's a great relief, it's a great freedom, it's a great happiness. It's very easy for monks, nuns, upasakas, upasikas who've read the Dhamma to say, yes, you know, the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths. You know, the five khandhas are suffering, the six ayatanas are suffering. Yeah, you know that, you think, but you haven't really truly experienced it. Why? Especially with those first five ayatanas, the first five senses, they've always been there for you. You've been surrounded with them ever since you were born. So you don't know anything else other than seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. As far as your experience of the mind is concerned, it's just karma vitaka. It's the mind remembering, planning, fantasizing about sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches. It's still the same world. You haven't exited the world when you're just thinking, or fantasizing or dreaming. You're in the same world, but it's as it's echoed in the mind. It's not pure mind state yet. So when you enter that first jhana, you have those two experiences. First of all, something is missing. You understand what these five senses are now. And also, something is so pleasurable, you realize those five senses, in even their best form, are dukkha. So you will never expect any more. Hopefully, this should be very clear to you. Never think you're going to get any happiness and satisfaction anywhere in the realm of the five senses. So stop messing around in that world. Stop trying to control it. Stop trying to get a healthy body. Doesn't matter how much you try, you will always get sick. There will always be aches and pains. There will always be disappointments, sights you don't like. Even the very best, even the great rich people, wealthy people, the great Maharajas, even they cannot control that five sense world. It is suffering for them. And there is an escape. And that escape is the jhana. Escape from the world of the five senses. Try it and see. And when you do get that pleasure, when you emerge afterwards, just inquire, why is that pleasurable? And you'll get it very clear that the five sense world is suffering. You understand why monks renounce that five sense world. Second jhana becomes even more interesting. Because, as I've mentioned already, the great feature of the second jhana is its stillness. This is the first time you really know what samadhi is in its fullness. And of course, samadhi should not be rendered as concentration, as stillness. Please, if you get that translation in your head, it makes a part of meditation very clear. The how to and where to, very, very precise, stillness. And this is the first time that mind is in perfect stillness, when nothing moves. Rock-like, diamond-like, which is what the second jhana feels like. I shouldn't really tell you too much detail about this, because as a teacher, you're going to come up to me, and you're going to explain your experiences. When I tell you what to say, you come up to me and say, yes, I had this experience. It was rock-like, it was still. Because you hope it's no second jhana. It's just, this is the nature of your mind. I'm putting in too much information. Sometimes you like to keep a few secrets there. So when you come up and you tell things you haven't heard, and I know, okay, right, you've got it, that was second jhana. But nevertheless, it's so rock-like and so still that something is missing. Something which has always been there for you has now gone. When you emerge afterwards, you can't know while you're in the jhanas. You're gathering the information, collecting the data, you analyze them afterwards. Just like the simile of a scientist, if you're in a laboratory doing science, you collect all the data first. You don't make any conclusions halfway through the experiment. If you do, you're going to start messing around with the data which you get in the second half. This doesn't fit my conclusion, and you sort of put it aside. So you have to collect all the data first, and then you find out what it means. So you collect the data within the jhanas, and afterwards is where you analyze it. So you realize in the second jhana and above, but the second jhana is the first time it stands out, something is missing, which has always been there. Strange. And it's your will. Your ability to choose, to do, to act, to react. That is no longer there. You may think that, oh yes, I can stop my will. Yeah, you can stop it, you cannot use it, but it's still there for you. You can take your hand off the steering wheel, but the steering wheel hasn't disappeared. You can remove your fingers from the button, but the button is still there. If you really want to any time, you can just press it. In the second jhana, there are no steering wheels left, no levers, no buttons. They've all vanished and disappeared. You can't do anything. It's impossible. It's not you just don't choose to. You can't. You're stuck. Still, peaceful. And it's weird. It's one of the reasons why jhanas are incredibly scary. Because you've lost control, totally. And that is one of the scariest things for a human being. to be totally out of control. The only reason why it makes it scary is because you've never been like that before. You just don't know what to do. But these things happen anyway. And there you are. And you come out afterwards and you realize actually that was quite nice. It's not quite wonderful not to be a control freak. That's even in my life now. Ask Prem, who looks after me. I don't run this program. I just ask him, what am I supposed to do? And he says, get up and teach. Get down and go an arms round. That's what I do all the time, wherever I go someplace. Whoever's looking after me, they said, oh, now you've got to give a talk in Royal College. So I get up there, open my mouth and give a talk. He said, now you've got to get down. So I get down. It's not so wonderful doing that. He said, now you've got to get in the car. You've got to go somewhere. So I go somewhere. I don't know where I'm going, but there you end up somewhere. And I love that because I don't make any choices and it's all the same. Wherever you go, there you are. It's all the same whether you're in sort of Bandarawella or whether you're in New York or whether you're in sort of Australia or in Malaysia. It's all the same. So it's wonderful when you just totally let go. And you enjoy your life so much more when you have to plan all these things. And how am I going to get back to Colombo on Monday? What am I supposed to do? How am I going to get from the wherever I get to where I'm going to go next? That's a pain, isn't it? Isn't it wonderful just to have to be totally out of control and let go? But that's what it feels like, times a million in the second jhana. You just can't do anything, at last you're free. One thing when you come out afterwards, you know what will is. Because you've been to that place where it's not. Just like the simile of the tadpole. Only when water disappears can you know what water is. Only when will has gone do you realize what this will truly is. Now, you all know in theory, because the core teaching of the Buddha is anatta. There's no self in there. There's no me, no mind, not a self. You all know that in theory. But do you still think that you're the person choosing? Do you really assume that it was your decision to come on this retreat? That you decided to get up this morning and sit in this particular seat? Do you really think that that was your free choice? If you do, you haven't penetrated anatta. You still believe that someone's in control. And that's this me, somewhere in my head or in my heart somewhere. That somewhere behind my eyes is a being watching. And of course, that is a total ridiculous, illogical delusion. But we buy into it. We really think we are in control. That's why we argue with each other. Who was right and who was wrong. If I do anything wrong, it's not my fault. I didn't have any choice. I had to do that. There are many examples of that from modern science. I mentioned already that, well, you all know that my history, that I went to Cambridge University to study theoretical physics. But in those days, universities were such that your course was only a part of what you were studying there. You had so much time and freedom to explore other areas. And I remember when I first went to Cambridge, the tutor told us, look, your study area is only part of what you're supposed to do here. You've got some of the greatest professors and lecturers in the world in this great university. Explore not just your own field, but other fields. Exploit all of our resources, not just in your own area of expertise, but in other areas as well. So I went to lectures in philosophy and architecture and other things. That was part of your education. And I also joined three societies. Of course, the Buddhist Society of Cambridge University. And you know that was just such an exciting thing to actually to see there was a Buddhist society in that university. Because before that time, I thought I was the only Buddhist in the whole of England. I didn't know any other Buddhists. And there I went to university and found out there were other students interested in the same things as I was. And that just gave me so much joy and happiness to realize that there was a place where I could practice and learn more Buddhism. But the two other societies I joined was the Astronomical Society, because I loved sort of looking at the stars and understanding what they're up to up there. And the third society was the Psychic Research Society, investigating ghosts and other paranormal phenomena. And at that time, one of my best friends became, his name was Tony Cornell. He was the head of the group. Later on, he rose up the ranks of psychic research And he became the expert, and I'm not exaggerating, the expert in ghosts in Great Britain. He was the head ghost hunter in the whole of that land. And whenever there was any reportings of hauntings, he would be the one who would go there with all this high-tech equipment to try and get that elusive picture or evidence that there was a real ghost there. And he became like a personal friend. The last time I went to UK, which was about a year and a half ago, we did arrange to have dinner, but he was a bit too sick. So had dinner with his wife and a few other friends. That's lunch, you know, lunch dinner. So he was a great friend. But as well as hunting ghosts, what we also did as students, every year we had a lecture from a hypnotist. He was a professional hypnotist. And of course, being young men, it was mostly good fun. We'd ask for volunteers. And I volunteered to be hypnotized, but I was not a good hypnotic subject. I had too much mindfulness. But there's always a few people who could be hypnotized. And every year there was always one student who was put in a total trance. And he was made to do very stupid things, humiliating things, which made us all laugh. But then the hypnotist did this one little exercise which I will never forget. He told this young man that soon he'd be taken out of hypnosis. And later on, during the lecture, when the hypnotist touched his own right earlobe, that this young man would stand up and sing the British National Anthem in a loud voice. No, God Save the Queen. And he told him he won't remember that when he comes out of hypnosis, but when the ear is touched, he has to stand up and sing God Save the Queen. And then he took the young man out of hypnosis. And of course, everyone in the audience saw that, but this young man could not remember it. And later on during the lecture, the hypnotist touched his right ear. And this man stood up in the middle of the lecture, as if one of you stood up during the middle of my talk and sang the Sri Lankan national anthem. It was so hilarious that many of us wet our pants. It was just we couldn't stop ourselves. It was hilarious. But when we stopped laughing, the hypnotist asked this man, "Why did you do that? Why did you sing the British national anthem?" And he gave a logical reason. What became very clear to me and everybody else in that lecture was to that young man, it was free choice. It appeared no different than any other choice he made in life. To him, it appeared he chose freely to stand up and sing the British National Anthem. No matter how ridiculous it was, how illogical, to him it appeared a free choice. And that was the first time I began to doubt whether what I recognized as will was really coming from me. Once you get into these jhanas, you realize none of it is coming from you. It is totally conditioned. You are totally conditioned by your teachers, your upbringing, your past. It's not you who's deciding to nod your head in agreement. You had no choice. It appears as choice, and that is the illusion. And of course, that has huge effects in your daily life. When you realize that there's not a person behind this will, but the will is one of these great cause and effect processes, not coming from a sense of self. Half the illusion of self, of atta, is taken away from you. You realize there's no one in there who's making these decisions. It's just a process, cause and effect. And the reason why I talk like this is nothing to do with Ajahn Brahm. It's because my teacher taught like this. He conditioned and brainwashed me. And it was Ajahn Chah's teacher, Ajahn Mun, brainwashed him. And his teacher brainwashed him. And the brainwasher in chief, the guy who started all of this, is the Lord Buddha. He's brainwashed a lot of us. Thank you. And that's why we meditate. That's why we do these things. That's why in the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, what it said, once that wheel of Dhamma is set in motion, no being could stop it. It's apatiwatiyang. Unstoppable. Why? Conditions were on. That's why it's lasted all this time. It's not up to will. Once it's brainwashed, once it's there, it can't be stopped. So there, that's why you choose to do what you want to choose. And that's why we have teachers. My job in this retreat is to brainwash you. And I've been brainwashing, whether you like it or not. You may react and say, I don't agree with this, I don't agree with that. You may sort of rebel, but it doesn't matter. It's too late now. It's in there. But the ramifications are immense. To give a simile, years and years and years ago, I developed a simile which I called a driverless bus. All about will. Because many of you came here on a bus. Many of you will go back on a bus back to Colombo or wherever else you're going. And when I was coming on the bus up here from Colombo, especially going, you know, up into the hills, there's some very beautiful waterfalls and very beautiful scenery. You know, and I sort of wanted to ask the driver, can you please stop or slow down? Because in Australia you don't see so many waterfalls, especially in Perth, it's very dry there. But of course the driver didn't stop, just carried on. And I know that sometimes that's what it's like in life. You're having very wonderful, pleasant experiences and you want to slow down to enjoy them. And what happens in life? They go too fast. It's like you're in a bus looking through the window and there's beautiful scenery and the bus driver speeds up. The happy experiences of life last too shortly. And other times, when the bus is in heavy traffic in Colombo, say, come on, get out of here, you know, I just want to get to some peaceful places. And what happens? The bus driver slows down and has a cup of tea. That's what happened by November when I came to Sri Lanka. And the conference organized buses to go to Kandy to worship the tooth relic, which was very wonderful, but it took forever to get there and ever to go back. And halfway on the journey, this was a bus. It's only 150 kilometers and it ran out of petrol. You'd think the bus driver would fill it up before he left. So we got stuck halfway while we had to search for some gas station to get some petrol. So sometimes you get stopped in places you don't want to stop. That's life. Sometimes you're suffering. You've got sickness, pain, aches. You want to get rid of that. Come on, bus driver, get out quickly. And the bus driver stops. Many of you think that it's your bus driver is the problem, your will. And if you manage to strengthen your will and give it lots and lots of wisdom, it means that you won't have so much suffering in life and more happiness. You'll be able to get out of the unpleasant situations of life quickly and stay longer with the pleasant situations of life. So many people start Buddhism because they want to strengthen their will and make it smarter, more wise. But if you want to wise, smarten your will and strengthen it, you've got to find what it is, first of all. So you've got to find where the bus driver sits, the will. And that is the job of samadhi, of jhanas. You go to the bus driver's seat. That's called second jhana. Just like you go up the bus. Imagine a real bus. You go up to the front where the bus driver is supposed to sit. And imagine what would happen in the middle of the traffic. You know, going down the road, you find the bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one there. That's what it's like in second jhana. There's no one there. There is no bus driver. There is no will. It's just an empty process. The bus is on automatic pilot. And that gives you a great shock. It's not what you expect. The result of that is you go back into your seat and you stop complaining. No more desire and ill will. How can there be? Who's there to blame? There's no one there. It's a waste of time shouting and complaining with ill will. If you've done something wrong and upset me, it's not your fault. You're not there. So why shout at you? I'm shouting an empty space. If you've been a wonderful monk, you'd be very kind and caring to me. Now why express gratitude? Gratitude to who? There's no one in there. There is no bus driver. So that takes away a lot, if not all, of craving and ill will. Because all that comes from will, from jhana. When you say, it's no one in here, there is no will, it's just a process. It doesn't come from a sense of me or I or self. That changes a lot of how you look on life. It's much easier to let go when you know there's no one in there. So that becomes one of the great experiences of second jhana. At last you understand what chaitanya is. You remember the Four Noble Truths. What is the core thing you're supposed to understand and let go of? Craving. A particular type of will. Of course, you're not finished yet. But after the second jhana, you can understand what craving, what will is. Even as someone mentioned, it was a very good question yesterday, even the first jhana, 99% of will is gone. It's enough for you to see that there's nothing really there. Now the other place where people think they exist, the other place where people assume this is deep down inside of us, there is a sense of self, is in the knower. Just remember those two halves of the mind, the doer and the knower. Sometimes you think, well, I may be out of control, but at least I'm the one who knows this. Now already, in the first jhana, the five senses, the five consciousnesses are gone. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And now the only consciousness which is left is mano, mind consciousness, the knowing. When you emerge after that, when you understand what knowing truly is, just like pure gold, you know what pure gold is when it's nothing else around it to give any imperfections. Once you know what knowing is, because this is what happens in jhana, this is just knowing, that's nothing else. Once you understand what knowing is, and you look at the process of cognition, what you're actually doing right now, you can separate out the knowing from seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. The Buddha did say there are six different types of consciousness. And many people don't really reflect on that deeply enough. They are different types of consciousness. They're not the same. They're not just different modes of consciousness. They are totally separate. So many years ago, I gave a simile of the fruit salad, it was called. Someone else gave it that title. But I said, like, imagine that seeing is like an apple. That hearing is like an orange. Smelling is like a banana. Tasting is like a mango. Feeling is, what's another? What did I use for feeling? Feeling is like sort of, what's another sort of, sorry? Pineapple. Okay, thank you. And knowing is like coconut. I do that because the apple of the eye, sort of banana nose, and I like mangoes, tasting mangoes, and coconut because you know, it's like a big head with sort of lots of milky stuff inside. So that's six different fruits, each representing the different senses. Now imagine you've got your alms bowl, and you see there is an apple in the alms bowl. It's a moment of sight consciousness. And then you see the apple totally vanish, and in its place comes coconut. And then you see the coconut vanish, and then you see a banana. And then you see the banana vanish, and then a coconut. Then the coconut vanish, and another fruit. But you notice that every fruit is followed by a coconut. And that's actually what sensory consciousness is like. What you see, you know you see. So sight consciousness happens, and then mind consciousness knows it sees. Then maybe smell consciousness, the banana, and then you know you smell. And then pineapple. And then the pineapple totally vanishes, and the next moment coconut is there. You know you felt. Every moment of consciousness is discrete, separate, different. But the thing is, because the coconut follows after every fruit, that gives the illusion of a stream and flow of consciousness, as if there's something similar between seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. There's something similar there. And it's that similarity, where we don't know what it truly is, gives the illusion that your knowing is continuous, that you're always knowing. And because of that, you think there must be a knower, something which knows, which is constant. When you see the six different types of consciousness as totally discrete, it's like a simile of the stretch of sand on the beach. From a distance, it feels like it's a continuous stretch of sand. When you go up close, you realize it's made of particles, small, tiny particles of silica sand. If you go up closer, you realize they're not even touching, and it's nothing goes across from one grain to the next grain. That becomes your experience of what this consciousness is. Nothing goes across from one moment to another. When a coconut disappears, it totally vanishes. And a new thing appears. Sight. And that disappears. Sometimes what happens is coconut, and then coconut, and then coconut, and then coconut. I knew something. So I know something. Then I know I knew. There is a great fault in Western philosophy, which says, I exist because I know I exist. But really that particular philosophical error is seen through when we realize we don't know that we know, we only know that we knew. We don't know that we know, we only know that we knew. When you put time into that piece of Western philosophy, you see its error, you understand the flow of consciousness. Discrete, one after the other. Now that is not kalapas, that is not abhidhamma, that is just what happens when you experience the consciousness, the mind consciousness, and know exactly how it works. So it takes away the illusion of a continuous knower. And anyway, if you do develop the jhanas up until the fourth jhana, and then start doing arupas, as I mentioned, the experience there is the consciousness or mind consciousness vanishing. You see it disappearing, which again is very scary stuff if you look at it from this point of view. But when you're in these jhanas, these things happen automatically. You've got no control at all, it just happens. So when you see the consciousness vanishing, just like the little tadpole, now what's vanishing is the knower. Once you see the knower is subject to cessation, no way will you ever believe that you are the one who knows, that you are the citta. You realize that that is a delusion of people who haven't seen either arupa jhanas, or haven't seen just the nature of the six discrete types of consciousness. You have the stuff of enlightenment here. And it's because of that simile of the tadpole, because of my own personal experience. Even though I do admit that some places in the suttas it does seem to imply that you can become a so-one, I'm talking about the attainment of stream, meaning the pala, not the magga, without the jhanas, I can't see it. It may be that I'm missing something, because you know, no one is as enlightened as the Buddha or as wise as the Buddha. Maybe I'm missing something, but personally I can't see how anyone could understand no self without at least seeing the will disappear, and at least seeing some of the knowing disappear. I can't see how a tadpole can understand what water is until it becomes a frog and jumps outside. And that is the reason why I've encouraged jhanas, why I teach jhanas, and why I spend so much time teaching the how-to and what happens when you get there. When you get there, you can find out for yourself. But at least, this is what will happen to you. to see non-self, which is the stuff of stream winning, that overcomes the kaya ditti. Later on, you get from this, the stream winner to anagami and beyond. It's basically just the seeing more deeply, or reinforcing the understanding of dukkha. One of the other things which I encourage people to do after the jhanas, one of the other great insights which people can get, is a memory of your past lives. Those of you who know the suttas, the teaching of the Buddha, said, know that after his attainment of jhanas under the Bodhi tree, the first watch of the night he remembered his past lives. The second watch was understanding karma and how it works. And the third, the Four Noble Truths. The Te Vija. In one of those suttas it said it's like the three breakings out of a chick from his egg. The first crack of the egg is seeing your past lives. The second crack is understanding karma. And the fourth crack, when you can crawl out of the egg and be free, is the Four Noble Truths. And sometimes we don't encourage enough the Te Vija, especially the recollection of our previous lives. And this is the time you can do it, post-jhana. Because post-jhana, the mind is incredibly strong. As it says, it's malleable, wieldy, anenja, imperturbable. It's hard to again use similes. But the simile which I use, and please forgive me because it's a gross simile, is like a well-trained dog. A well-trained dog, you can go and tell them in the West, go and fetch my slippers, go and fetch the newspaper. And the dog wags his tail, goes out to the front door, picks up the newspaper in its mouth and brings it back to you. It's so well-trained. Even in Thailand, one of the monks over there, someone gave him a monkey, and someone was torturing this monkey, so I gave it to the monk to look after, but it wasn't a wild monkey anymore. It was a cousin to a human being. So he actually trained this monkey to offer him things. Because, you know, sometimes there's no one to actually do the gapia. There's no one actually to offer him a banana. And the monkey would do this. And, you know, according to Vinaya, that's allowable. Just like in the Parilaya Sutta, the Parilaika forest, now the Buddha was served by a monkey and also by an elephant. And so when you haven't got a kapya around, you know, a kapya karaka, an attendant around, he had this monkey, and it was so good. All this monk had to do, he'd point up to a banana in a tree. He didn't need to say anything, because that might be against the Vinaya. Just point to a banana. And the monkey would go up there, take the banana off the tree, come down again, and offer it to the monk, and put his paws up. As an offering. It's very convenient when, you know, lay people are busy at work or something. Now that just shows you how you can train an animal. Now when your mind is trained, it's like that monkey. After a jhana, you just say, go and get me a past life. And the monkey goes away and brings you back a past life. Basically, that's what it's like. So how I advise people to do this is just when you come out of a jhana, reflect upon it, but before all the energy goes, just make a suggestion. What is my earliest memory? I don't know where that came from, that's what I used. What is my earliest memory? And then, first of all, it seems just my own experience and those of others, you get an early memory as a baby, first of all. Now, the earliest memory in this life. And all you need to do is say, earlier, please. Just like say to the monkey, another banana, please. And the mind just goes and brings you another memory. Many people get their experience in their mum's womb. What it's like being a fetus. Earlier, please. And then you get your past lives. Now, having said that and having taught that for quite a few years, there is a danger, and I want to warn you about this so you can avoid it. Sometimes when people do this exercise, when they get to their previous life, they get the most recent memory and the strongest memory, which is of your death in your previous life. And to some people that was very painful. I remember one young lay meditator said he did this and he got experience as a baby earlier, please. And he got this terrible experience of his death. And it was so unpleasant, he said, I never want to do that ever again. And of course, you can understand why, because your death moments can be very, very painful. So if ever that happens to you, you know, you're after the jhana, what's my earliest memory, and you get this experience of your death, immediately just say, earlier, please. And then you lose that memory of your death, and you go, you know, into another important memory of your previous life. You avoid that problem. I mention that because it can be a problem. It's just sometimes what they say in psychology, traumatic, to remember a very, very painful, unpleasant previous death. So go earlier, get some other previous life memories. Now the great thing of that insight which comes up is an experience. I should mention to you that if you do this past life experience, if it comes up, it comes up very clearly. Not just like a hazy picture, not a maybe. I've got this sort of vision of like me in sort of soldier's uniform or something. No, it's very clear and precise. You know exactly who you are, where that is. You just need to actually ask questions. It's like you're inside that old person in a previous life. You just ask, what's my name? How old am I? Where am I? Just asking those questions, you get answers. It's as if they're investigating, moving around inside that previous life. So you can access all that information. And most times people, when you do that, it's very clear, yes, that was me in a previous life. So you really have no doubts. But if you really want to, and it was a previous life where there may be some records, just for your own interest, check it out. Prove that it's true. But the most important reason I encourage that is because, once again, it gives you the big picture. But not just one life, but just a whole series of lives. Because one life can be not that much suffering. But when you look at the whole series of your lives, many, many lives, that shows you what the First Noble Truth truly means. I still don't think that anyone can fully understand the First Noble Truth unless they've experienced their past lives. They just know the suffering of one body. And maybe they can infer bigger suffering, but just one body is not really enough. Hundreds, thousands, innumerable lives gives you the full picture of the First Noble Truth, which is why it's important. Why that gives you the opportunity to understand the Four Noble Truths fully. So please, use the jhanas for that as well. You do need that strong upachara samadhi, sustained for a long period of time. Post-jhana one is by far the best. And all these things which you read about in the suttas, you find you can do. Psychic powers, forget about them, they're a waste of time. They're a little bit of fun and games, you know, like when you have, I don't know what you have in Sri Lanka, but sometimes in cornflakes you get these free gifts sometimes. And if you buy a packet of soap, you know, you might get a free pen or something. They're just like the free gifts which you get with samadhi. But, you know, they're just a little bit fun and games, but they're not really all that useful. But understanding the Dhamma is very useful. So that's actually how you use the jhanas for insight. And in my experience of being a monk, I can't say how anyone can get those insights without those jhanas. To sum up, it's the jhanas eradicate the five hindrances, the pancha nivarana, for long periods of time. Not totally, but for long periods of time. Afterwards, you're free of hindrances, for hours sometimes. Number two, it gives you the data. The tadpole, becoming a frog, and seeing things have totally vanished. And that's weird. But now you understand what those things were. And you can never rely upon them as something stable and solid to hang up the side of a self, a me, an Ajahn Brahma, or wherever else you are. And three, it gives you the opportunity to access things like past lives. And with past lives, the understanding of the law of karma. All those great insights come to you as a result of a powerful mind with all the data which those states give you. That's why I encourage the jhanas. Having said that, once you have experienced the jhanas, that's what you'll do. I've already brainwashed you, conditioned you. You'll be automatic now. Best of luck. Okay, that's the talk on insight. I'll give some more explanations on insight later on this evening, this afternoon. Okay, so happy meditating.